Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Chuang Tzu. Now, Chuang Tzu, you all know, lived ...300 BC, something like that. More than that. But Lao Tzu was his teacher. Lao Tzu lived 2,500 years ago. So that's about year 500 BC. So around in there somewhere. And very astute man. And he says, a man of Tao acts without impediment, harms no other being by his actions, yet he does not know himself to be kind and gentle. He does not struggle to make money, and he does not make a virtue of poverty. He goes his way without relying on others, and he does not pride himself on walking alone. The man of Tao remains unknown. Perfect virtue produces nothing. No self is true self. And the greatest man is nobody. One of the most difficult things to do, I think, is for us to keep the mind in the middle. Mind, your thinking mind, the mind in the middle is a mind in balance. So I guess we're usually lopsided. A mind in the middle is not prejudiced, it's not dogmatic, and it doesn't discriminate. Now, usually in our thinking, we move from one thing to the opposite. We move from near to far, hot to cold, you know, from here to there. That's the easiest way to do. You know, to move from one polarity to the opposite polarity. It's not only the easiest, it seems to be quite natural. Because we find everywhere that nature is always trying to bring together a balance. In the animal kingdom, if there's too much of one kind of animal, some kind of disease hits them. Or let us say the coyotes eat rabbits and there's too many rabbits and too many coyotes, the rabbits get a disease, so the coyotes have nothing to eat, and so it cuts them down. This is nature's balance. And we find that throughout the history of man, a man has either had plagues, or when it gets to a certain point, they go to war. This is the way they keep it chopped down, to try to bring a balance about. However, we don't usually look at this, and we don't understand it. There's a whole lot of it about it that we should understand. because it is always a trying to bring about a balance. Our own bodies, when we have a symptom of something, it is simply the body saying, look, there's something in here that's out of balance. You do something to make it right again. Bring it back into balance. See? And the mind should be in balance. So, or as we say, in the middle. And we, over and over and over and over, we don't see this, we don't pay any attention to it, and we miss the mark. Yeah. Our conflicts, you know, are simply trying to bring things back into balance. You go from this end to this end and just stay in the middle. The conflicts just drop. You know? It's kind of like the pendulum of a clock, you know. It moves to the right and it moves to the left, and then it moves to the right, and then it moves to the left. And the clock, to keep telling time, you know, whatever you want to call it, it depends on this movement. Huh? Mm. If the pendulum remained in the middle, the clock stops. Yeah. Now, if you stopped all of a sudden, just stop, the mind stopped, where would you be? If all of a sudden the thinking mind just stopped, what would you be? When the pendulum moves, let us say to the right, we think it's going to the right. You know, that's what the mind is fixated on. It's going to the right. Yeah? But at the same time, you see, this is what we lose sight of, that it's moving this way to the right. It is also gathering a momentum to go. So the mind goes in this one direction to one pole, say to the right, but at the same time, it is gathering this momentum, and you can watch it build so that it's going to go the opposite direction. The opposite may not be apparent. Usually it's quite hidden because we're not looking at everything, we're just going in this direction and gathering things that will help to build the momentum of going in this direction. You know, we move in that direction. We forget even the point from which we started. You know, from whence we came. You know? And then we move to the opposite. And we learn the art of meditation. Let us call it an art. The art of meditation, to remain in the middle. You know, the Buddha taught 8 disciplines. He started out with the 4 Noble Truths, you know, and out of this arose the 8 disciplines of the right thinking and the right effort and the right action, you know. The word right, or sometimes we say correct. So it is a right effort or a correct effort. Now, it's very easy to slip from action into inaction. It's very easy to go from a waking state to a sleeping state. Well, what about the middle? Huh? And when he says the middle is right. And if he talked about food, he would say right food. He didn't advocate fasting. Now, he tried it and he saw that it did do harm to his body. But at the same time, he didn't advocate overeating. Just right. The body needs nourishment. Give it just that. Right mindfulness. It's in the middle. The mind in balance. Now, if you're in the middle, you're not gathering all this momentum. And if you're not gathering all this momentum, You can be at ease with yourself. And if you are at ease with yourself, you can be at home anywhere. There's a story told about a mystic, Mujed, his name was, and it is said that when he attained enlightenment, the clock on his wall suddenly stopped. Now, maybe it happened and maybe it didn't happen, but the symbolism is quite clear, huh? When the mind stops, time stops. When the pendulum stops, the clock stops. What we know as usual time is created by the movement of the mind. The mind moves, and so you become aware of a time. You know, it's like the little corn, not so little, of the two monks arguing about a flag fluttering in the breeze. And one little monk says, well, it's the flag is fluttering. And the other one says, no, the wind is blowing. And after a bit, you know, they're sitting there with this argument. Nanzen walks by, the Roshi. And they put the question to him. And he says, it's neither. It's your mind that's moving. Mind moves. If the mind doesn't move, where is time? So, time is a motion sensation in your world. If there's no motion, time disappears. And then eternity comes into existence, which is not forever time, you know. No. Eternity is now. There was a man by the name of Omar, and he inherited a clock from his grandfather. And he was very proud of it, and he loved his grandfather very much. So he put this clock, rather an ornate clock with a big face, you know, in a very prominent position on a bookcase in his living room. And, I mean, it didn't keep good time. Sometimes it was fast, and sometimes it was slow, and sometimes it stopped, you know. But he was very proud of it. And he enjoyed it. And he didn't care if it didn't run. He just liked the clock. But the clock became a focal point for conversation. Somebody would walk in and say, hey, that clock isn't right, is it? You know. Omar, your clock has run down. Does this clock work? You know, all these questions. So Omar was getting fed up with it, and one day he told his friend Giovanni that he was thinking about having the clock repaired. Not that he cared whether it kept time or not, but he was so tired of discussing its inaccuracy. So Giovanni, he didn't say anything. He just went over to the clock, and he removed both of its hands, and he wrote, now, on its face. Yeah. And those of you who knew Witt Van, he said something one day to the effect, here, I am thinking about being so-and-so. Here, I do everything so that my life is nothing except here. 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 You cannot live there, there, or there. You can only live here. Here I do all that I can possibly do. Outside of here, I can do nothing. And all comprehensive here, which is now, is life facts, is here now. Here now, I think of the past. Here now, I think of the future. Here now, here now, here now, here now, always here now, for here now is the accepted day of the Lord. Here now is eternity, not endless time. Yeah. But we have this polarity of thinking that we should look at. And we begin to understand it, and we can then begin to understand maybe why we look to the future and we look to the past. After all, here's where we are, you know. And that future is in the distance. What's here now may be very boring. You may be fed up with it. You don't like yourself the way you are. So you begin to dream of a future. Something distant. There, out there is hope. Out there is the possibility of pleasure. It's there. All I have to do is get there. So the most distant becomes the most dreamy. And it attracts you. And it beckons you. And it calls to you. And it invites you. And when you finally reach there, which is the day after tomorrow, maybe, let us say, the other place, you know what happens? The old becomes very attractive again. It's like the pilot, you know, that was flying with his friend over California, Northern California, and he says to his friend, "Look down there, isn't that a beautiful lake? I was born near there, in that village." And he pointed to a little cluster of buildings perched in the hills near the lake. And he said, "When I was a child, I used to sit at the lake and fish. Fishing was my hobby. And at that time, when I was a child, fishing, the airplanes used to fly overhead. And I would dream of the day when I would become a pilot." Yep. Now that dream is fulfilled. Now I'm looking down at the lake and I'm thinking about when I will retire and I can go fishing again. Yeah? You see? This is what we do. And we do it in minute little things. And we don't watch ourselves with this. And so this thinking mind, it moves back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, left to right, left to right, left to right, right to left. It is an infinite process that never ends unless you suddenly drop out of it. And then you'll become aware of this little game that you're playing. You stop in the middle. And in the middle is meditation. Yeah. And then people will say, "Well, yeah, we meditated for a few years, and then we found that it took too much time. Or we tried this meditation business, and you know what? It became boring. It wasn't any fun anymore. At the very beginning, it was fun. But now, after a couple of years, it isn't any fun anymore." And so the mind, of course, it wants this activity. It wants this swinging back and forth, this motion, you know. And it begins to look for something else. Yeah. Now, there are many forms of meditation. Uh, You know that, huh? There is one form that is called meditation, where you sit to reduce tension. Yeah, it's called meditation. But this is the opposite of tension. You can reduce your blood pressure. You can slow down the heartbeat. I call it yoga. Meditation to me is more than sitting down there to stop, you know, to slow down your heartbeat, huh? Yeah. And there's meditations upon a mantra, and there's a meditation observing a koan, and there's a meditation observing your breathing, and there is a meditation on remaining in the middle. When you are in the middle, when you're in balance, see, then you're whole. You're total. And this is what meditation brings you to, this totality. When you are whole, then you're holy. And your thinking, your ego thinking, isn't running the show. Something else has entered the picture. Ordinary thinking all of a sudden isn't. So people call it, Zen calls it particularly a state of no mind, because ordinary thinking isn't. It's so balanced. It's meditation without thinking. So what are you doing when you are not thinking? As a general rule, I have found with people that when the mind gives up its tensions, then all of a sudden you're at ease. You feel pretty good about yourself. Everything is nice and smooth. But when that happens, you begin to look around, you know, you begin to eye the whole situation for something to get disturbed about. You want to move in that tension again. And when you're in that tension again, then it comes, oh yeah, I guess I should meditate. Yeah. It's kind of a game of polar opposites. Do you really want to live your whole lives in this kind of activity? Moving from left to right, from one pole to the other? A man of Tao acts without impediment. Harms no other by his actions, and yet he does not know himself to be kind and gentle. Impediment is our divisiveness, this continual subject-object, which is a polarity, huh? It's are not being whole. Part of us moves, that's the activity, and part of us is not moving, that is that which is observing the activity, huh? But when the whole moves, you know, then there's no impediment. Then we say of it that the movement being whole is a universal motion. You know, from the Isha Upanishad puts it so neatly, you know, individual movement in the universal motion. And then all this becomes a habitation by the Lord. Now, when one is whole and is moving with the totality, you know, sometimes they call this state bliss, from the Sanskrit ananda. We have the three particular states of sat, chit, ananda, the mind and that. Now this bliss, if we can use this term, this feeling of wholeness is not something that comes to you from the outside. Somebody doesn't come along and give it to you. No. It's just this feeling when the totality is, there is no impediment, there is nothing that has divided you. It's just this feeling that comes with total being. And it isn't something that is happening to you, it is you. It is simply the harmony of the whole. But if you're divided, either subject-object, half moving, half withholding, half saying yes, half saying no, this is a divided kingdom. And we have conflict. Have you heard the story of the centipede? He's walking along on his 100 legs. Centipede, you know, that's his name, 100 feet. Now, it's a miracle to walk with 100 feet. Yeah, even to manage two sometimes is difficult. And here he's got 100 to manage. But the centipede has been managing very well. Long, long time he's been managing very well. But one day a fox came along. And the fox watched this centipede and all these legs moving. And he became very curious. You know, foxes are always very curious. You know, in folk stories, folk tales and lore, the fox, you know, represents the intellect and the logic, you know, the cunning of our analysis. Foxy, we say, And the fox looked at the centipede, and she observed this centipede, and she analyzed this centipede for quite a while, and she just couldn't believe it. So she said to the centipede, "Wait a minute, don't move so fast. I have a question. I need to ask you something. How do you manage? How do you know which foot has to follow which foot? You walk so smoothly. How does this harmony happen?" And the centipede stopped and looked at the fox and said, "Well, I've been walking this way all my life, but I never thought about it. Give me time to think." So he closed his eyes, and for the first time, he became divided. He observed the legs, observed the feet. There was the observer and the observed. He had been living and walking and being all one whole. And now he had become subject and object. And then he started to walk. And it was an impossibility. Because how do you manage 100 feet? Really? The thinking mind had come into being in this little centipede. And in the throes of subject and object, about where we find ourselves, isn't it? So now comes this meditation where we gradually come into balance, and the observer again becomes the observed one. Meditation, And it was just the opposite that had happened to the centipede. He became two. We are already two. We need to be one. Two, the thinking and the thought. And right there, that centipede froze. Says Chuang Tzu, the man of Tao acts without impediment. Now, does that make sense? Okay. He isn't divided. What is to impede him then, if there's no division? He just moves in his wholeness. He moves in his harmony. He moves in his unity. And that movement is total. And it is, I might add, the greatest beauty that can happen to you. Yeah. Sometimes you have glimpses of it, huh? The sun rises. And you look, and all of a sudden, the observer isn't present. Just seeing the sunrise, the thinking is still asleep. So it's not there to manage the situation. In Zen, you know, we speak of eye consciousness and ear consciousness. Just to see. Just to see. And to hear. Just to hear. And taste. Just to taste. It is a non-ego. Seeing, hearing, tasting. Eye consciousness. Ear consciousness. Of course, if we're looking at the sunrise, all of a sudden the ego steps in, and here comes the analyzer. Here comes the observer. Oh, how beautiful! Isn't the sunrise lovely? See? And all of a sudden, you've lost that very precious moment. You begin, even though you may not be aware of it, but you are comparing this moment to other moments, or comparing it to you don't know what. How lovely. When you say how lovely compared to what? Whenever the glimpse happens, you know, let the glimpse be present. Just let it. You don't do what the centipede did. Don't raise the questions of which foot comes first now. You know, you just walk with 100 legs. But don't think how you're walking. You be the walk. You be the hearing. And you be the seeing. Non-ego. Now, a man of Tao acts without impediment, harms no other being by his actions. Now, it's not that a man of Tao cultivates certain aspects, such as what we have found in the last 20 years or so, people cultivated non-violence. No, and it isn't that a man of Tao cultivates compassion. And it isn't that he leads what is called the good life. And it is not that he behaves in a saintly manner. He does no harm because he has stopped harming himself. He has no wounds to bind. A man of Tao is not a man of much activity. No, because all the unnecessary has been cut out. Can you be with yourself, just yourself? What do you do when you are alone? Let us say, for instance, you were going to be alone for 3 weeks. Just alone. No radio, no television, no phone calls. You're just alone. Well, maybe for the first few days, you dream about this thing. It gets to be a rather dreamy state, you know, and there's all this chattering that goes on within about what you're going to do when the 3 weeks are over and what you're going to do with these 3 weeks and so on. But after a while, because there's no new input, it gets boring. See, there's not activity anymore. So what happens then? You begin to talk out loud. Because then at least you hear the sound of your own voice. It's like when you walk down a dark street, you whistle. Does the whistling give you courage? How does whistling go when you're walking down a dark street and you whistle? How does it help you? Just by listening. Because by listening and you're whistling, the illusion of two all of a sudden is present, you know. There's a hearer and something heard. There's two, so you're no longer alone. Anyway, you're all by yourself here for all these weeks, three of them. What happens? The first week you begin to talk out loud, and the second week you answer yourself, and the third week you've got an argument. Yeah. You know, if we're occupied, you know, our the energy moves out, you know, because occupations are out there, huh? And when we move out, as a general rule, the inner world is forgotten. And so much of what we do in our moving out is not essential. It's not necessary. Look at your activities. How many are essential? And there are many people who will not drop this non-essential because they're afraid. If there's no radio and no TV and no hi-fi and no newspaper and nobody to talk to, what will you do? Are you really afraid of yourself? That's why a lot of people can't do it. But if you have no radio and no TV and no hi-fi and no anything, and only you are there, in these circumstances, other than you, what is there to be fearful of? It's surprising what we do in the name of common sense, in the name of giving, in the name of all kinds of things that are only we're only doing because we're afraid of ourselves. You know, this activity that we are engaged in so much of the time. There was once a priest, we could say a minister, a pastor, a rabbi, whatever you want to call it. We'll call him a priest today. And because he had this clerical frock on for so long, of course he expected to go to heaven when he died, and he died. And he arrived. And everything was beautiful. The house he was given was one of the most palatial he had ever seen, more so than he had ever dreamed of. And any time any desire arose, immediately a servant appeared. If he was hungry, the servant brought food. He didn't have to ask. The servant knew he was hungry. If he was thirsty, the servant brought him something to drink. And it was the most delicious food and drink he had ever tasted. And this continued, and it continued. And he was very happy for about 3 days. And then he began to feel a little uneasy. After all, a man has to do something. You just can't sit in a chair all the time. and this priest became uneasy. As a holiday, this kind of a rest, that's fine. But he had been a busy man. He had all his public service, he had the missions, he had the church, he was delivering sermons, and he was involved in the community. And yeah, he needed a holiday, but after all, how much can you rest? Holiday is supposed to come to an end. And then you want to go back to your usual world. Right, huh? He was uncomfortable. And suddenly this servant appeared and said, "What do you want? This feeling of yours is, it's not thirst and it's not hunger, it's just uneasy. What should I do for you?" And the priest says, "Well, I can't sit here forever and forever. I cannot sit here for eternity. I cannot sit here for all that time. I want some activity." And the servant said, "But that's impossible. All your desires will be fulfilled by me. So what need is there for activity? It's not provided for here." And with this, the priest became alarmed. "What type of heaven is this?" And the servant looked at him and said, "Who said this was heaven? Huh?" Poor soul. No talks, no social services to be done, no pagans to be converted, no foolish people to be made wise. What was him there for him to do? Nothing. Now you've only got yourself. That's all. And there's going to come a day when that's it, folks. You've got only yourself. What are you going to do with it? Yeah. A man of Tao does not know himself to be kind and gentle. Well, if you know that you're a simple soul, you're not. When you are gentle and don't know it, and when you are simple and not aware of it, then it's just your nature. When nothing is imposed, you know, it's like enlightenment, you know. It either is yours or it's a facade. When the facade is in place, you're aware of it. When it is just your nature, it just simply is. You know, a person that shows off his religion is not yet really religious. It's still kind of like a thorn pricking. It isn't natural. It hurts. And so he has to show it off. You know, I wonder sometimes about these people that have, well, I won't go into that. If you want to show your simplicity, what kind of simplicity is it that you have to show? If you have to exhibit your gentleness, is it really gentleness or is it being foxy? It's kind of like this man who had suddenly acquired a great deal of money. I mean, suddenly. And he bought this big, beautiful home for himself with a nice big yard. And he ordered 3 swimming pools to be built. And one day he was showing them to a friend, and the friend was very puzzled, you know, 3 swimming pools? Oh, you know, 1 would really do. Oh, no. 1 is for hot baths, and 1 is for cold baths. people who like hot water and people who like cold water. And the third one, that's for people who can't swim. No water. You know, a man of Tao has forgotten this kind of exhibitionism. So, do not allow your meditations or your thinkings about your meditation to become a coinage for an entrance into the unknown. Do not bargain when you are whole. Then you are very rich in the inner world, and you are not concerned with this kind of exhibition. You don't go, let us say, to the temple and allow your prayer to be a little louder than anybody else's. Or you don't go to church and you sing a little louder than anybody else, you know, because you have to show off. Showmanship is part of the ego, and it can be past master at the game, huh? The man of Tao is simply an empty boat. He's gentle, but he's not aware of it. He's innocent, he's wise, and he can move without worry. What he does doesn't make any difference because his wisdom remains intact. It's kind of like Henry Ford. You know, he went to England. And there is at the airport in England, there's a place where you can go to get some place to stay. They all over Europe they have these little offices, and people line up and say, "I got a Bank of America card. I'll stay any place," just so they accept a Bank of America card. And places are hard to get there. Anyway, so he goes to this inquiry office at the airport, and he asks for a cheap hotel, and this clerk looks at him. And he recognized the face, after all. It had been highly publicized that Henry Ford was coming to England. And here he was, and he's wearing a coat that looked about as old as he was, and he's asking for a cheap hotel. So this clerk says, "If I'm not mistaken, you are Mr. Henry Ford, are you not? Well, why are you asking for a cheap hotel? I have seen your son come here. He asks for the best hotel, and he wears the best of clothes." And it is said that Henry Ford replied, "Yes, that's my son. He is not yet attuned to himself. There is no need for me to stay at a costly hotel. Wherever I stay, I am Henry Ford." And my son being new still, he's fearful of what people will think, and wears the best of clothes. This suit I have on belonged to my father. I don't need new clothes. I am Henry Ford, no matter what I wear. Even if I am standing naked, I am Henry Ford. You know, they do say he was interested, quite interested, in the esoteric teaching. Yeah. The man of Tao remains unknown. Perfect virtue produces nothing. No self is true self, and the greatest man is nobody. This, you know, this is the old thing about if you are acting out of a state of, shall we say, enlightenment or whatever, it doesn't create any consequences for you. And we all know that we can be somebody. In our own eyes, we are all somebody. but we also realize we can never be the greatest. We can never be the greatest somebody. There will always be somebody greater somewhere in the world. Right? Yeah. Now that great somebody, how do you measure him? There is an artist that is the greatest artist in the world. There is a teacher that is the greatest teacher in the world. There is the greatest runner that is the greatest runner in the world. There is a pugilist that is the greatest pugilist in the world. You know, how do you measure? How do you measure? You are the measure. It's like a spoon measures the ocean. You measure other people. We are all teaspoons measuring. Yeah. And the greatest of them all is immeasurable. Yeah. It is the illimitable. Yeah. And you measure, and you measure, and you don't look. This true man of no rank, who is the greatest nobody, going in and out of the gates of your face. I'm sorry to keep you so long. I've got a sidetrack somewhere. Now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.